And we are now with the Ralph M. Brown Act. Karen is taking the lead on this.
Good morning, everyone. This is our annual education session regarding the Brown Act. And someone asked me this morning, how many times have we done this? And we do try to do it annually. We go over these fundamental rules about open meeting laws in California that we're subject to make sure that everybody remembers the basics. And is able to spot issues if they come up and watch out for pitfalls. So that is why we do this. I do have a slide deck, and that should be in your agenda packet. I'll refer you to slide number 2. And this one talks about generally the Brown Act and that it sets forth the rules regarding open meetings held by a local legislative body in the state of California. And so the SACERA Board of Retirement is subject to the Brown Act. The purpose of the Brown Act is to ensure that the public agency actions are taken openly and that the public agency deliberations are done openly. The key concepts of the Brown Act is that the retirement board meetings must be open and accessible to the public. A board meeting agenda must be posted publicly. And during board meetings, the public must be given an opportunity to comment. So my shorthand to these key concepts is that we have to keep in mind that we have to give notice to the public and an opportunity for the public to participate and be heard. Notice and an opportunity to be heard. And we'll be coming back to these concepts as we talk about some more of the Brown Act fundamentals. Slide number 5, what is a meeting? A meeting of the board has to be done publicly. We have to have notice, we have to have an opportunity, provide an opportunity for the public to participate. What is a meeting? A meeting means any congregation of a majority of the retirement board. In our case, it's 5 retirement board members at the same place and location, including teleconference locations, to hear, discuss, deliberate, or take action on any item within the retirement board's subject matter jurisdiction. So a meeting is what is taking place right now. All of you here, we have a quorum of the board, and we are meeting in public. But also, if someone were to call in telephonically and have a conference call, that would be a meeting as well.
Karen, are you going to talk about, at some point, the practical application of this that at least sticks in my mind, that public meetings, we can have as many as the entire board, but if it is a controlled or private meeting in some form, we're limited to 4?
Yes, we are going to cover that on slide 6, and that's a really good comment. Thank you, John. So, of course, we have to have public meetings. We are not allowed to have secret meetings, and if you have a quorum of the board, 5 members, meeting someplace else, let's say a bar or someone's living room, if you have 5 board members there, then that would be a meeting, and it would be subject to the Brown Act provisions about having to be properly noticed to the public and allowing the public an opportunity to be there and participate. anything under five members, it would not be a violation of the law. And so on slide six, we also talk about what a serial meeting is, because a meeting is not only five people in one place. It can also happen if there's a sequential communication among five board members. And so the Brown Act says that a meeting also means any serial use of communication, personal intermediaries, or technological devices through which a majority of the board members discuss, deliberate, or take action on an item. So it could be via email or social media or anything like that once you have a quorum of the board discussing a board business item. That constitutes a meeting under the Brown Act, and that needs to be done in public with proper notice to the public. For example, an unlawful serial meeting would occur if board member A emails to board member B about his or her position on a retirement board issue. B forwards A's email to C and then forwards it to D, who then forwards it to E. So now we have communication among five board members. That's a quorum. That's a majority of the board. And that series of emails constituted a meeting. That cannot be done outside a public meeting that's properly noticed to the public. Are there any questions about what a meeting is or serial meetings? Okay, so we'll go on to slide number seven.
Karen.
Yes.
Tell me about this. It's not a meeting, it's a conference. And five of us are at this conference. And we're having breakfast together, and suddenly an issue surfaces that we've been dealing with for years. That is a non-topic. We can't talk about it.
Correct. The five members of the board can be at the conference together if the conference is open to the public. They may not discuss business items of the Board of Retirement.
Even issues that have been resolved.
I'd say that would merit further thought. Possibly that would be okay, but if this is,
it would be best not to talk about it.
If it's a type of item that might come back to the board or is an ongoing issue that the board will be dealing with, I would say no. You should not be doing that.
Right.
And then, so this slide actually talks about your question with conferences, Jerry, and explains the rules about a majority of the board can attend the conference if it's open to the public. It doesn't have to be free, by the way. The conference can have a fee associated with attendance. And so this slide gives some examples for those conferences that board trustees do go to, such as SACRS, which is open to the public. There are other conferences that are not open to the public, and then we need to limit the number of attendees, board member attendees, to less than five so that we don't run afoul of the Brown Act. Are there any questions about conferences? The Brown Act does have a few exceptions in it, exceptions that make sense, and one of them is the attendance of a purely social gathering, maybe a wedding or a funeral. That is fine. A majority of the board can attend those. Again, they may not discuss a business item of the Board of Retirement at that gathering. So now we turn to the more technical fundamental requirements in the Brown Act regarding the agenda. And so we talked about the key concepts being notice to the public and an opportunity for the public to be heard. This talks about the notice to the public. The notice to the public comes in the form of an agenda. The agenda has to be provided to the public at least 72 hours before a regular meeting of the retirement board. The agenda has to contain a general description of each item of business to be transacted, including items to be discussed, and the time and location of the meeting must be posted in a public location and the SACRS website. And so this provides the public proper notice about where and when the public board meeting will take place, what issues will be discussed, or possibly taken action on.
And this is also true if there's a teleconference as well. The agenda has to be posted in advance, and that location also has to be open to the public.
And where does it have to be posted? Just here, normal? It doesn't have to be like when Scott and I were down
it
south?
It has to be on site.
So we would post something if we were off site?
Yeah. Right
there
in
that building. Okay.
Yes, and the idea there is you're part of an open public meeting wherever you are. So if you're in New York somewhere, you still have to post the agenda there and make sure that if anyone is there in New York wanting to attend the Cicero Retirement Board meeting is able to be there.
If you were going to do it from your hotel room, would you post on the front door? How would you do that?
That would not be a public place. So no, that would not suffice.
On the outside of the front door.
You could post it on the bathroom downstairs.
That is the trouble and the difficulty with the teleconferencing. You do have to find a public location that the public at large can access.
And it has to be still 72 hours?
Yes.
I think I shared with you that in connection with working out for Gabe and I to call in last year, I think it was about a year ago, actually. Mm-hmm. I had a city council member in the Los Angeles area call in from Cancun, which I kind of questioned as a public place in terms of the swing vote calling in from a hotel in Cancun in a public place that was accessible. I haven't looked at the statute since then to see if anybody's bothered to try to amend it or to put some territorial limits on the use of that provision, but I thought it was interesting. It doesn't matter where you are in the world, at least under the current statute. As long as it's a publicly accessible place, you can participate.
That's correct.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well,
question is just technicality. So does the statute say that the remote people that are remote have to be in public mm-hmm. as well? Or is it that they're presence has to be public, meaning here.
The location has to be publicly accessible.
That they're attending to the conference, or is that in addressing like a teleconference when we would just have a teleconference, for example? Let's say we were all remote for whatever reason, and we wanted to hold a board meeting via teleconference, meaning all the board members were attending. Would you have to provide access to all five locations?
Yes.
Is it defined in the statute, or is it just a public attendance? Are they able to attend the teleconference publicly?
Each place where a board member is located would have to be a public location and open to the public.
Mm. So you could participate while driving in the car or calling from home.
Right. No. That would not be allowed.
So I think there's a limitation in the statute, though, that you have to have, I think, a quorum of the body in the normal place, mm-hmm. the normal meeting place,
yes.
in order to do that. In other
Correct.
Words, we all can't be remote at hotels around the world and call in and have a call. You just can't do it. As much as somebody might want to try it, can't do it. Yeah.
Yes.
You have to have a quorum of the body here, okay. and then those who couldn't be here are dialing in.
Yes, you do have to have a quorum of the body here, and that reminds me, it's a little bit of a preview to our next educational session, which Harvey Lederman will lead, about your fiduciary duty to be in the seat and attend board meetings and participate in discussions and take action. So we'll be talking about that a little later on. Good questions. Thank you. So now we are on slide number 10, still talking about the agenda requirements in the Brown Act. And again, the fundamentals here is that we're providing notice to the public about what the retirement board will be discussing, where and when. And so the agenda, of course, has to describe the items that the board will be discussing. What happens if an item comes up that is not on the agenda? Well, if an item is not included on the agenda, the retirement board may not act or discuss that item or add that item to the meeting's agenda as an urgency item, subject to limited exceptions. So there are limited exceptions. Generally, you may not discuss an item that is not on the agenda, but there are exceptions. One of them is that the board can have a, by two-thirds vote, can decide to discuss an item that is not on the agenda, but there has to be a finding that the agenda item is an urgent matter that requires the board's deliberation that day, and also that it came to the attention of SACERA after the posting of the agenda. So those are very, very limited circumstances, but they do allow for something urgent to be considered by the board, even though it is not included on the agenda. As to items that are not included on the agenda, the retirement board, although you may not discuss and take action on the item, you may, the board members and staff may ask a question for clarification, make a brief announcement, or make a brief report. Retirement board members may provide reference to staff or other resources, such as outside consultants, for factual information, request staff to report back to the body at a subsequent meeting concerning any matter, or take action to direct staff to place a matter of business on a future agenda. Any question about the agenda? Okay, so now we move on to public comment, and that's on slide number 11. During each meeting of the retirement board, the board must allow public comment on each agenda item and on other matters within the jurisdiction of the board.
Have you considered putting something in writing saying it's 5 minutes or something like that?
You may do that.
Yeah, no. I think it's helpful. We had this discussion before to right. have a 3 minute, and then at the discretion of the chair, you can shorten or lengthen it. But I think it just provides a little bit more certainty, and as people come to speak before the board, if they know that they'll be provided with 3 minutes, we do that with the Board of Supervisors. Right. Agendas where we say how much time public comment will be allowed.
I can see it in writing because that way somebody knows ahead of time. Somebody comes here, all of a sudden they're blindsided. So
it's true because they prepare their comments
right.
exactly to be right at 3 minutes, or if we tell them
good.
2 minutes, yeah, it is. And I think in most cases, if there's something where you need more information, then you can ask follow up questions and allow them that extra time.
But Gil, can we put that? Is it possible to add that in the policy?
So the Brown Act, of course, does. The Brown Act does allow the board to make this decision and limit public comment to something reasonable, like 3 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, whatever it is. Boards that have a very large agenda and a lot of public comment, such as the Board of Supervisors, sometimes City Council, they do have this ongoing rule, and it's published. So the board may choose to do that if you see a need for it. We would probably have a separate discussion with the board and get the sense of the board about whether there's a majority supporting that.
Okay.
So up until now, we talked about meetings being open, providing notice to the public, providing the public with an opportunity to attend and make public comment. The Brown Act, though, does have exceptions to that and does allow, under very limited circumstances, the board to meet in closed session for particular items. And then there's a requirement about what needs to be reported out to the public about those items and the timing of that report. So slide number 12, here we have a list of some of the Brown Act exceptions, those that are that allow the board to meet in a closed session in a confidential setting. So examples are one thing that is unique to those local governmental bodies that hold public pension fund investments is the first example here, and that is the authorization to meet in closed session to deliberate or take action on the purchase or sale of a particular specific pension fund investment. So in that case, the agenda would have to simply say that, describe that situation, and also include a reference to the government code section that allows it, without any further detail. And that is a recognition by the legislature that certain things, including some investment decisions, can be done in closed session if there's a need to protect the system's leverage in going into the transaction or pulling out of a transaction. Next, we have the retirement board may meet in closed session on personnel matters. So issues like the appointment or discharge, discipline of an employee could be done in closed session. The board may also meet in closed session with CSERA's designated representatives regarding employee salaries, benefits, but the board cannot take final action in closed session on those matters. That action needs to be done in public. There is actually something new in the law as of a bill passed this year, but it'll be effective January 1, 2017. And that new requirement is that if the board is, or any board, is taking action on executive contract and specifically salaries and benefits, there's now an additional requirement for the board to provide an oral report to the public prior to taking action, and that report has to summarize the recommendation. So that's an added layer of transparency having to do with executive compensation and executive employment contracts.
I can think of a matter where that process would have benefited the outcome.
You do think?
Really?
Yes, I think we can all read your mind there. By the way, that bill is SB 1436. It was recently approved by the governor of the state of California, and it'll amend the Brown Act, specifically Government Code Section 54953. So next on our list, on slide 22, we have another closed session. And that is the retirement board may meet in closed session to confer with legal counsel regarding pending litigation, exposure to litigation against CSERA, and to decide whether to initiate litigation. All of that can be done in closed session. And lastly, with regard to closed session, that is confidential, and board members may not disclose confidential information acquired by being present in closed session to a person not entitled to receive the information.
Karen, real quick, could you go back to that slide? I just have one question that I didn't ask at the beginning of the slide. So the first bulleted item, which is talking about the purchaser sale of a particular specific pension fund investment, I mean, you could make the argument that when we get down to a finality of a specific fund that we're investing in, that you may be able to deliberate that in closed session.
Yes, absolutely.
But we typically do not.
You can. You are allowed to. You don't have to, but you're allowed to.
Got it. Just wanted to clarify. Thank you.
Yes.
Karen?
Yes.
It's probably straightforward, but the second bullet talks about personnel matters. It just is a confirmation that does not include compensation. Or benefits?
That does not include compensation, correct. There's another code section that allows you to confer with your representative about compensation. And you can do that in closed session, but you can't take final action on it in closed session.
But we're distinguishing between personnel matters.
And salary matters, correct. Mm-hmm. The other thing I'll point out with regard to the personnel exception is that it does allow the board to also meet in closed session to discuss disabilities and take action on whether to grant or deny a disability application. All right, so we talked about the notice requirements and providing the public with an opportunity to be heard, and that's all in the Brown Act. There's also consequences to violating the Brown Act. There's criminal liability for individual board members for violating the Brown Act. There's civil remedies, civil actions to stop, prevent, or invalidate the action of the board if there's been a Brown Act violation. And also attorney fees and costs can be awarded to the plaintiff if they prevail. So in the next few slides, I'll run through them quickly. We give more detail about criminal liability, potential civil remedies with regard to violations of the Brown Act. And at this point, I'll ask if you have any questions. No? Well, that concludes our... Oh, yeah, Harvey.
Could you go back to slide 14? This is the one about criminal liability where the member intends to deprive the public of information.
Yes.
It's hard to see from the language of the Brown Act whether or not there's co-trustee liability there. If David, for example, had that intent, are the other board members liable as well? Or is there an obligation to discern that intent? How does that section work?
In my opinion, the plaintiff would have to prove intent on the part of each trustee. So, in other words, if they could prove that more than one trustee, we're not picking on you, David. or Gabe. So if the plaintiff is able to prove intent on the part of more than just the one board member, they could probably go after all of them. But I think they would have the burden to prove that.
So this is keyed off attending the board meeting. So if you had a serial meeting that violated the Brown Act, would it be covered in here?
A serial meeting of the Brown Act would be a violation of the Brown Act.
Right.
You're asking if the criminal liability... Okay, so again, I think it boils down to intent and whether the plaintiff can prove intent on the part of the trustees that engaged in the serial meeting.
Give us another example, Harvey, with David as an example.
So David forwards the fourth email.
He's D, forwarding the E.
And he forwards it to Will. Right. So the last person in that chain, I mean, I would think that'd be a tough case. In other words, if you get an email from somebody,
right.
We get hundreds of emails every day, I know we all do, and sometimes you look at it and you say, oh, that's interesting, you want to forward it to so-and-so, and you do that. I mean, your initial forward, you didn't think might wind up in the hands of four or five or on, you know, TMZ. But it does happen, right?
So this is why we have this discussion, and you feel like you do it over and over again, but it makes you aware of it, and it makes you at least spot the issue and know that if you're, number one, please don't reply all. Just don't click on that reply to all. Don't do it. Number two, if you have an email and it's from a board member, start thinking about, number one, we're not covering the Public Records Act here, but your communication via email from one board member to another is going to be public record. In fact, if you end up with this serial email chain, guess what? It's public record.
Don't worry, I have a separate server.
Yeah. Okay. Whether you use your Yahoo or Gmail account or another. So those are all good questions, just things for you to think about as you go through your business and take care of your, fulfill your fiduciary duties. Keep in mind these Brown Act issues and watch out for them and feel free to ask me if you have any questions along the way. With that, I'll turn it back over to our chair.
Thank you. And we now have